Well, good morning to everyone. How many of you are familiar with a book that came out back in the late 60s? It was a runaway bestseller. Still, you see it on the book stands from time to time. It's entitled, I'm Okay, You're Okay. How many have that on your bookshelves at home in your libraries? Of course, many of us would. Many of us here in the, doesn't seem that many of us here do. I do, personally, and I see some of the others here do. But I'm sure a lot of people hearing this tape will have that book and be familiar with it. It was a pop psychology book. It was very popular at the time. Some would call it a lot of psychobabble, and perhaps that's appropriate. I'm not sure. But in any case, it was a book about the application of what is known as transactional analysis, meaning simply that psychologists, those who have studied human behavior, have broken down the various aspects of the human psyche into three categories: parent, child, and adult. Now, the parent is that aspect of us, of our minds, that sets the rules and adheres to the rules, abides by the rules. Of course, some people who had no rules in their lives as children, had no set standards, have an underdeveloped parent. That's, you know, keep in mind, we're not talking about three persons in one being, nothing like that. We're talking about three categories within the human psyche. And then the other category, one of the other categories is known as the child. That's that playful part of us, that part of us that likes to go out and run on the beach, even though we may be in our senior years. It's the playful part of us. And then there's the adult. And, of course, it's most critical that the adult be developed as time goes on, from childhood and upward, because the adult controls, as it were, the child as well as the parent. It is the adult that has the capability of analyzing the rules of the parent. You know the rules of the parent. All of us have those rules tucked away in there, instilled in our mind. You know, eat everything on your plate, make up your bed, look both ways before crossing, etc., etc., etc. Now, of course, when you get down the ways in life somewhere, you find that some of those rules were intended for particular circumstances and no longer apply in this situation. So it takes the adult to analyze the rules that were instilled early on and then determine whether they appropriately apply. So the development of the adult aspect is very important. It is also the adult who controls the child. It is the adult who deems or who decides when it is appropriate to let the child get out and play, as it were. So that's what the book basically was about, and it was merely a way of understanding the human psyche in practical terms so that people could deal more effectively with the day-to-day issues of their lives. But in this book, it's the book itself, in showing the complexity and describing the complexity of the human mind, reports on a series of fascinating experiments that were conducted by a gentleman named Stanley Milgram of Yale University. Now, some of you know what that experiment consists of. Some of you don't. I'll go ahead and tell you about it. Milgram took a sample cross-section of the adult male population of Bridgeport, Connecticut. And there were almost 1,000 of these adult males who were taken in this experiment. And their ages ranged from 25 to 50. They were told that they would act as teachers in a study on learning techniques. Now, of course, that was not true. That's what they were told, but that's not what this study was about. They were told, we're going to have you sit here at this desk or at this panel, and you're going to administer an electrical shock to the learner who is in another room, an adjoining room, when the experimenter tells you to. And so these teachers took this job, and they were told, again, that it was a study on learning techniques, when in reality it was a study on obedience. But they couldn't be told that because it would mess up the experiment. Each teacher, as I said, was to deliver an electrical shock, and I don't know how they did it. I suppose either by pressing a button or turning a dial or flipping a switch. We'll assume it was flipping a switch. To the person that was identified as the learner who was in the adjoining room. Now, the teacher was there with the experimenter and therefore couldn't see the person in the other room, but he could sure hear him. And he could hear what happened every time he flipped a switch. And here's the way the experiment was conducted. The experimenter would ask a question, and the learner in the room, in the adjoining room, would answer. And every time the answer was wrong, then the teacher, that's from the volunteers, from that almost 1,000 of adult males from Bridgeport, Connecticut, the teacher would throw the switch if the answer was wrong, upon the command, of course, of the experimenter. So he'd throw the switch, and with each succeeding wrong answer, the electrical shock became more intense. So it started with a low voltage, and it moved upward with every wrong answer. And, of course, the sounds that came out of that room corresponded with the amount of electricity going in, as you might imagine. Now, one thing, though, needs to be cleared up right away you need to understand, and that is, in reality, no electrical shock was being administered at all. But the teacher, the person taking the role of the teacher, thought that he was administering an electrical shock. And when he would hear the sound in there, he was sure of it. And to confirm it, before the experiment began, they had each one of the teachers get in that, it was an electric chair of sorts, they strapped them in, hooked them up, and they gave them a little sample shock of 45 volts. So it seemed awfully certain that they were actually, when they would throw the switch at the command of the experimenter, that they were actually administering an electric shock to that person in the other room. So it went something like this. Now, by the way, the sounds that they were hearing were really not from that person. They were pre-recorded. But it went something like this. The learner gives a wrong answer. The experimenter tells the teacher to throw the first switch. He throws the first switch. Whoa! Right. You know, that's the sound he hears coming out. And then he goes on, answers another question. It's wrong. The experimenter commands the teacher to throw the next switch, 165 volts this time. The first one was 150. He throws the switch. Whoa! It's worse. And he begins to think, boy, I don't know about this. So the next question, the wrong answer. Experimenter, throw the switch. Teacher says, okay, he throws the switch, 180 volts, and it's really bad. He's thinking, this guy's going to die. And then another wrong answer. The teacher says, wait a minute. I can't take responsibility for this. The man, listen at him. He's hollering in there. He's in pain. We can't keep doing this. I can't take responsibility. You don't know whether he has a heart condition or not. He might die with another jolt like that. And it keeps getting worse. And then the experimenter says, you don't have to worry. I'll take responsibility. You do your job. So he throws the switch. And on it goes. 195 volts, 210, 225, 240, and so on. And you can imagine what it must sound like by the time it gets up about 250 or 260. Probably pretty bad sounds. Now, of those almost 1,000 men selected as teachers, what percentage would you guess went all the way with it until there were no other switches to throw? You know, a group of 40 psychiatrists who studied the project predicted that 0.1% would go all the way. What would you guess? Would you believe a full 10% went all the way? That's 10%. If that's your guess, you're wrong. 20%? A little higher. 30? If you guess 50%, you're still wrong. We're not talking about 1% of 50%, 1% of 50%. We're talking a full 50%. You're still wrong. The truth is, 62% obeyed the experimenter's command fully, all the way to the last switch. 62%. You think, where did they get these guys? I thought you said cross-section. Out of the local, you mean cross-section of the penitentiary, right? No. The cross-section of society. Adult males, 25 to 50, responsible men, family men, men who would never think of inflicting torture upon another human being, certainly not an innocent human being. And yet, here they were, taking it all the way, and all because they knuckled under to the perceptions regarding the authority of the experimenter. You see, if it hadn't been for that perception there, had it been perceived as someone who was under them, someone lesser in authority, lesser in stature, then he wouldn't have, I'm sure the percentage would have been much better. They wouldn't have taken it all the way. But because of that perception, 62% went all the way to the last switch. Now, this is an extreme example of what I want to talk about today. But I think it illustrates the point of how one person can influence another. The influence of one upon another can be seen, in fact, in every level of human interaction, all the way from the military to the family unit, even down to simple peer pressure on the playground at the elementary school. You see it everywhere. One person or a group of persons influencing somebody else. It's everywhere, and it is inescapable. A lot of people would think, well, the solution is it would be to do away with authority, have no more authority figures, but you know that's impossible. It is impossible because normally we think in terms of, when we think of an authority figure, especially those of us with a particular background from an ecclesiastical tradition, think in terms of someone who is exalted way up there so high, you know, you have to bend back like this to see the bottom of his feet, that kind of appointed office. But that's not what we're talking about here. You know, everybody in this room is subject to some authority figure. If you're a parent, you are an authority figure of sorts, to some extent. You are an authority figure, hopefully to a very powerful, a very significant extent. And chances are that those of us here who are not authority figures of some type will eventually be authority figures. People who become medical doctors, of course, are authority figures. You know, there was a time when you would go to medical doctors. It doesn't seem to be the case anymore, at least in my experience. Perhaps I'm wrong. But there was a time when certain medical doctors, when you would go to them and you would question their diagnosis or question what they were recommending, that they would kind of look at you like, who do you think you are to question me? I am the authority here. I've noticed in dealing with doctors around town that it seems that it's not that way so much anymore. But there was a time when it was. You know, after all, this is the guy who went to school. This is the guy who burnt the midnight oil in studying medicine. And now here you are, this fellow that comes along, and you don't know that much about medicine, and you're challenging him. So a lot of conflict can emerge from situations like that. And on the other hand, a lot of people will knuckle under and do what the authority figure says, even though that may not be the best thing. Maybe they should have challenged his recommendations. Maybe they should have sought a second opinion. But in any case, authority figures are throughout society. Doctors, judges, police officers, and in the church, elders and deacons. Not only that, but leaders in other levels. Sabbath school teachers, to some extent, are authority figures. You cannot escape authority figures. Even on a job, when you go to a job and you're the latest person to be hired, you're on the bottom of the list, as it were, and you have a lot of authority figures there you're looking up to, as it were. And yet, in time, when you build up a little seniority, other people are hired later than you, then you are looked upon as somewhat of an authority figure. So that's what I'm talking about here. And this interaction, given the way things are perceived, as far as positions that people hold, titles that people have, functions that people take on in society, in the church, wherever, then we will always have authority figures. And we will always have one person influencing another person. And it's important to understand that the power of one over another is not exercised only by means of spoken commands. It is also exercised by way of personal example. And that's what I want to talk about today. The title of this sermon is The Power of Example. Now, I'd like to discuss the effects of right and wrong examples upon other people. I think we don't fully realize to what extent one person can influence another. And probably many of us don't realize to what extent we have already influenced other people by the way we live our lives, by our speech, by the things we do, by the things we say, by the things we don't say. But let's take a look at this power of example today and show how that the example of an individual, and of course we'll keep it primarily in an ecclesiastical situation or consider that more than anything else, but we see it all about us in the political world and everywhere else. But let's start with Matthew chapter 18. There's something here that is a profound thought that jumps off the page at you when you begin to read this and realize that by your example, you can, and we're talking about a wrong example here, you can actually lead someone else to commit sin. Now, I've always thought in terms of a sin is something that each individual is responsible for, and that's true. It's absolutely true that you sin because of something that's in you. I can't blame my sins on somebody over there or the person over there. I sin because I have the problem. However, sins are often committed, or put it this way, certain sins would not be committed if it were not for the power of some influential person. And let me show you an illustration of that here in a couple of scriptures in Matthew. And the first one is in Matthew chapter 18, beginning in verse 1. So today I'm going to be reading from the New International Version. Verse 1 states, "At that time the disciples came to Jesus and asked, 'Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?' He called a little child and had him stand among them, and he said, 'I tell you the truth, unless you change and become like little children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Therefore, whoever humbles himself like this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. And whoever welcomes a little child like this in my name welcomes me. But if anyone causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin," let's read that again. "If anyone causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin," you see, you can cause somebody to sin. You might say the real cause is in the person who sinned. But here we're told that another person can lead them to that place where that choice to commit sin is made. And guess who has the greater condemnation? We'll read further. "It would be better for him to have a large millstone hung around his neck and to be drowned in the depths of the sea." Pretty powerful language there, isn't it? For causing someone else to sin. Now, he doesn't go into detail here in explaining how that can occur, but elsewhere, he gives us some very powerful clues as to exactly how it can occur. And certainly, the way this is worded here, this tells us that if we cause one of those precious ones that God is working with to commit sin, then if you read this the way I do, I think you'll have to conclude it's pretty frightening. He goes on to say, "Woe to the world because of the things that cause people to sin. Such things must come, but woe to the man through whom they come." Something to keep in the back of our minds everywhere we go and in everything we do. So while it is true that a person that commits sin, or he commits the sin, an individual does, because he chooses to commit sin, it is also true that in many cases, the choice to commit sin would not have been made had it not been for the power of example. Now let's go over to Matthew chapter 23 and focus here on something that Jesus said that, as I read this before, it just jumped off the page at me and so profound in my mind. Chapter 23 and verse 13, he says a lot of things here, of course, about the Pharisees and about the scribes. He says, "Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites! You shut the kingdom of heaven in men's faces. You yourselves do not enter, nor will you let those enter who are trying to." You mean somebody can keep you out of the kingdom? Well, that's what this seems to say. That even though you are trying to enter, that certain influences in society can keep you out. Now, of course, the influences will have the greater condemnation. He goes on in verse 15, "Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites! You travel over land and sea to win a single convert, and when he becomes one, you make him twice as much a son of hell as you are. The end result is he's worse than you, and you're pretty bad." And by how does he do that? By teaching him, by not getting the right day for Pentecost? Is that it? No, that's not what he's talking about here. If you look at verses 5 through 7 there, you will see what he has in mind. He says, "Everything they do is done for men to see. They make their phylacteries wide and the tassels of their garments long. They love the place of honor at banquets and the most important seats in the synagogues. They love to be greeted in the marketplaces and to have men call them rabbi. In other words, it's this great self-exalting pride that is exhibited in their lives. When they make a disciple, it is that pride that is passed on, and therefore the new disciple, in his innocence, becomes not so innocent, and the end result is that he's twice as much a son of hell or Gehenna as the Pharisees who made him a disciple to begin with. So a person could cause another person to stumble. One person, because of the power of example, I should say, can cause another person to take that path deeper and deeper and deeper into the way that leads to destruction. And if we're going to do God's work, which is the work of proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom of God to the world as a witness, if we're to make disciples of all nations, to make disciples for Jesus Christ, to bring about conversions, and certainly this is something we have to be very much aware of, is how we conduct ourselves in the eyes of the world. How we conduct ourselves in the eyes of those new disciples who take an interest, who are attracted to us and come among us. We don't want to bring them into a fight, do we? We don't bring them into a lot of squabbles. I've known of cases in the past where people were out there and were just on fire because of the truths they were learning. They were opening up their Bibles and finally beginning to learn things from the Scriptures. And then they started a church. Now, that's what we want them to do, isn't it? But boy, sometimes we bring them into a mess, don't we? And I just wonder, how does God feel about us when we do that? Something to think about. All of us, leadership as well as all of us. Let's go down to 1 Corinthians chapter 8. 1 Corinthians chapter 8, where the Apostle Paul deals directly with this power of example and how one, and in this case, one member of the church can influence another. 1 Corinthians chapter 8, beginning in verse 1, Paul says, "Now about food sacrificed to idols, we know that we all possess knowledge. Knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. The man who thinks he knows something does not yet know as he ought to know, but the man who loves God is known by God. So then, about eating food sacrificed to idols, we know that an idol is nothing at all in the world, and that there is no God but one." Now, you know that, don't you? I know it. When I go down to the China Cafe and I see that big Buddha standing there, I know it's just a piece of artwork, I guess. I don't know that anybody worships it. I doubt if anybody bows down before it. I don't know what they do with things like that. Not in this country, they don't do anything. It's just decoration. I don't know about other countries. In some countries, idolatry still persists. But, you know, you and I know that an idol is merely either a piece of stone or a piece of wood or some other material that's been carved into a certain shape. We know that, don't we? We know it has no power. It does not have a brain. It is not even capable of moving about. It just sits there. And that there is no God but one. And he's the one that brought everything into existence. In fact, the stuff that idol is made out of was brought into existence by the Creator. So there's only one God. Now, we know that. That's what Paul is saying here. "For even if there are so-called gods, whether in heaven or on earth, as indeed there are many gods, quote unquote, and many lords," that's things that are called gods and lords, "yet for us there is but one God, the Father, from whom all things came and for whom we live, and there is but one Lord, Jesus Christ, through whom all things came and through whom we live." And by the way, this is not saying there is one God, the Father, and then the one Lord is not God. That would be like saying that the one Lord, Jesus Christ, is the only Lord and that the Father is not Lord as well. No, these are titles of divinity. But that's just a little aside there due to the controversy that persists among some within this movement. Verse 7, "But not everyone knows this." Not everyone has this. They don't quite have a grasp of this yet. "Some people are still so accustomed to idols that when they eat such food, They think of it as having been sacrificed to an idol, and since their conscience is weak, it is defiled. Now, if I went down to the outback, if I go down there this evening or any other evening, and they bring out a big old delicious-looking steak, I'm not going to think, I wonder if the animal from which this came was sacrificed before an idol. I'm sure it wasn't, but even if that was practiced in this country, you know, I really don't care. I'm not going to worry about it because I have my mind on what that is before me, and that's a piece of meat, and it tastes good. And I don't care about the animal. The only thing I care about is that the animal was healthy at the time of death. Of course, it wouldn't be healthy after death, but it was healthy at the time that it was slaughtered, and it didn't have mad cow disease or something like that. But I don't care, really, if the person who slaughtered it is a Buddhist or any kind, or a pagan idolater of some kind. I don't care, because that's a piece of tasty-looking meat sitting there before me. And Paul essentially had the same attitude, and yet he recognized that there were some people, due to the influence of the influences of the culture in which they lived, that couldn't handle it. Eat meat that had been sacrificed in an idol's temple, or even that they thought might have been sacrificed in an idol's temple, without thoughts about the idol. They were, in other words, they felt that they were somehow tainted, that somehow they were defiled, that somehow they were participating in idolatry. And Paul addresses this here. He says, beginning again in verse 7, "But not everyone knows this. Some people are still so accustomed to idols that when they eat such food, they think of it as having been sacrificed to an idol. And since their conscience is weak, it is defiled." If you eat it, and you think that it's something you shouldn't do, but you do it anyway, then you have committed sin. Simply because you thought that it was wrong at the time, and you were knowingly doing something that you thought to be wrong. But food does not bring us near to God. We are no worse if we do not eat, and no better if we do. In other words, he's saying a piece of meat is just a piece of meat. Be careful, however, that the exercise of your freedom, that's those of you who know, you have knowledge, you know that a steak is a steak. Be careful that the exercise of your freedom does not become a stumbling block to the weak. You might ask, how could that become a stumbling block? You know, I used to think that the problem was primarily over the fact that some people who would eat meat sold in the shambles, possibly had been sacrificed before an idol, that it would cause other people to stumble in the sense that they would become angry and start pointing the finger of accusation. It's just like someone with a very strong Baptist background comes into the church, Church of God International, and they see some of us drinking wine or beer or something. Now we know, we have knowledge, we know that there is a proper use of alcoholic beverages. If taken in moderation, we're talking moderation, I know some people interpret that differently, but true moderation. If taken that way, we know that it's not a sin. However, some people who would see us would get upset about it and then would point the finger of accusation. I used to think that that's what Paul was saying here, and I think in Romans 14 he does have that in mind. But here he has something else in mind. It's another kind of offense. Let's read on in verse 10. "For if anyone with a weak conscience sees you who have this knowledge eating in an idol's temple, won't he be emboldened to eat what has been sacrificed to idols?" In other words, by the power of your example, you who are strong, by your example, he is led to do something that defiles him. You know, it's a fact that if you have a leader, someone who is looked up to, someone who is considered strong in the faith, if you have a leader do something that is not right, and it's done in the presence of those who look up to him, then the next time the temptation comes to do that thing that they saw the leader doing, the next time a temptation comes, there's a far greater likelihood that even though they know it's wrong, that somehow they'll manage to justify it a little more easily. And this is what Paul is talking about here. You can actually lead somebody to violate conscience because of your example. He says, "So this weak brother," verse 11, for whom Christ died is destroyed by your knowledge. When you sin against your brothers in this way and wound their weak conscience, you sin against Christ. And again, that's pretty serious stuff. Therefore, if what I eat causes my brother to fall into sin, I will never eat meat again so that I will not cause him to fall. So it's a fact, brethren, that the power of example, the wrong example in this case, can lead someone else to commit sin. Something we need to be aware of on a day-to-day basis, both in the church and out in the world from day to day. A wrong example can also bring reproach to the gospel. A wrong example can bring reproach to the gospel and to the name of God and to the name of Christ. Look at 2 Samuel chapter 12. 2 Samuel chapter 12. And of course, this is the account that tells of how David's adultery with Bathsheba, his murder of Uriah, that those sinful acts were uncovered, were exposed, that the prophet came to Daniel, or I should say to David, and the prophet Nathan came to David. You know the parable he used about the person who had the little lamb, and the wealthy guy came along and took that little lamb and slaughtered it and so forth. And then, of course, he was talking about David's own sin. And he goes on, let's look at the account without going through the entire thing, and particularly start in verse 13 there. It says, then David said to Nathan, I have sinned against the Lord. This is when David brought it to his attention that you are the man, David. You're the one who is guilty. Nathan replied, the Lord has taken away your sin. You are not going to die. You see, David did deserve death, but God made an exception in this case. He committed adultery and murder. Two major sins there. And he deserved death, but God made an exception. And Nathan reveals to them that you're not going to die, but because by doing this, you have made the enemies of the Lord show utter contempt, the son born to you will die. He's given the enemies of the Lord cause to blaspheme God's name. That's what he means here, by his behavior. In other words, it is now known to the surrounding nations, to the heathen, those who worship idols and not the God of Israel, not the true God. It is known by them that this great leader in Israel, David, the king of Israel himself, has committed these acts, and he has given them cause, therefore, to blaspheme the name of God. And by our example, by what we read here, by our example, we can give people cause to blaspheme the gospel. You know, to stand up and preach truths from the Bible and then to live a lifestyle that is not in conformity with what you're preaching, what is the world going to say? Well, I've got to get in there and hear more of that. Is that what they're going to say? No, you say, just look at the example. That tells you about the message. And so we can cause reproach to be brought to the gospel by our very example. In Romans chapter 2 and verse 24, the Apostle Paul says essentially the same thing. In Romans chapter 2, and well, let's start back in verse 17 and read our way to it. It says, now you, if you call yourselves a Jew, if you rely on the law and brag about your relationship to God, if you know His will and approve of what is superior because you are instructed by the law, if you're convinced that you are a guide for the blind, a light for those who are in the dark, an instructor of the foolish, a teacher of infants, because you have in the law the embodiment of knowledge and truth, you then who teach others, do you not teach yourself? Of course, the problem here was certain Jewish leaders within the church, or Jewish church members, were bragging, they were boasting about the fact that they had the law, they had a greater knowledge of the law, and so forth. And of course, it is evident from this passage that there was a little bit of hypocrisy here. But Paul is addressing the situation. He says, you who preach against stealing, do you steal? You who say that people should not commit adultery, do you commit adultery? You who abhor idols, do you rob temples? You who brag about the law, do you dishonor God by breaking the law? As it is written, God's name is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you. You know, a hypocritical example says an enormous amount, doesn't it? It sends a powerful message out there. And if we're standing here preaching the law, and yet, and I'm not talking about just the specifics, keep the Sabbath day, do this and do that. I'm talking about the, certainly we preach the spirit of the law, don't we? We teach those spiritual principles derived from the law. And if we're not living our lives in conformity to what we preach, then we're going to send a message out there that's going to turn everybody away, everybody that comes in contact with us. So this is what Paul is saying here, that we can cause the Gentiles, that's the unbelieving world, to blaspheme God's name by our lifestyles, by the power of example. Now, a right example can make the gospel attractive. Just as a wrong example can bring reproach to the gospel, a right example can make the gospel attractive. Look at Titus chapter 2. Titus chapter 2, and beginning in verse, well, let's start there in verse 1. Paul says to Titus, you must teach what is in accord with sound doctrine. Of course, Titus was an elder. Titus was being given instructions here as to the conduct of church services and preaching and ordaining and so forth. So he says, you must teach what is in accord with sound doctrine. Teach the older men to be temperate, worthy of respect, self-controlled and sound in faith, in love and in endurance. Likewise, teach the older women to be reverent in the way they live, not to be slanderers or addicted to much wine, but to teach what is good. Then they can train the younger women to love. You notice this, I ran right over it. It says to teach what is good. There is a teaching role for women in the church, by the way. And here it says so here. And of course, it defines it in verse 4. Then they can train the younger women to love their husbands and children. And by the way, that is a ministry for women, for older women in the church, training the younger women. And the younger women can have ministries as well. That's a subject for another time. Verse 5, to be self-controlled and pure, to be busy at home, to be kind, and to be subject to their husbands. Why? Well, not only because those are good things to be, but so that no one will malign the Word of God. In other words, so you won't send a message by way of a wrong example. Verse 6, similarly, encourage the young men to be self-controlled in everything set apart, in everything set them an example by doing what is good. In your teaching, show integrity, seriousness, and soundness of speech that cannot be condemned. Of course, he's talking to Titus here, and it applies to any of the elders in the church. In your teaching, show integrity, seriousness, and soundness of speech that cannot be condemned. You can always, when somebody is insincere, it comes across eventually, doesn't it? When somebody is unsound in his teaching, after a while, it begins to become known, doesn't it? But he says, it gives a reason here. Why to be sound in speech? He says, so that it cannot be condemned, so that those who oppose you may be ashamed because they have nothing bad to say about us. So you have a bad example in the pulpit. You have a person who's insincere. You have a person, he may be teaching the right doctrines, but if he's insincere and if he has any of these traits here that are certainly undesirable, then in due time, people will have something bad to say, not only about the speaker, but about the church that he represents. Verse 9, teach slaves. Of course, this realized this was a different society. Teach slaves to be subject to their masters in everything. And here this would apply certainly to the employee-employer relationships in today's world. To try to please them, not to talk back to them. In other words, be of a cooperative spirit. And naturally this is not talking about the situation where you have an abusive master or employer. It's not talking about that at all, but it's talking about the relationship that existed so often back then where you had slaves or servants and their masters, and where it was a workable situation. Verse 10, and not to steal from them, but to show that they can be fully trusted. Why? So that in every way they will make the teaching about God our Savior attractive. So this is not just for elders. It's for everybody on every level to consider the power of example. A bad example in the workplace can cause God's name to be blasphemed because the people you work with do know where you go to church, don't they? You don't hide that forever. Hopefully you don't hide it at all. In the church itself, wherever you go, your relationships, your family, your friends, your neighborhoods, this is telling us to be aware, whether you're a leader in the church, whether you're a lay member working in the community, on the job, or whoever you are as a church member, beware of your personal example, because you are sending messages, whether you know it or not. Now let's go to 1 Timothy chapter 6, 1 Timothy chapter 6, and beginning in verse 1, Timothy says something similar to what Titus says all who are under the yoke of slavery should consider their masters worthy of full respect. Again, why? So that God's name and our teaching may not be slandered. Same principle. The message you send in the workplace, in your relationships, in your family, among friends, everywhere in the world that you go, you send messages by your example. And if we're not careful, we can cause people to reflect or cause people to associate the bad example that we may set from time to time with what we believe here. Finally, setting the right example is a must for ministries. Any ministry, any service, and now I'm talking, of course, within the church, but also it applies to ministries or services dealing with the world. And in reality, everybody here has a ministry in the sense that certainly you would like to see your unbelieving family members converted, wouldn't you? And you take every opportunity, every time the opportunity presents itself, you take advantage of that opportunity, don't we all, to let somebody else know some truth of Scripture, something that they can think about, chew on, as we say, and maybe hopefully come around to conversion eventually? Don't we all do that? If we do, then we have a ministry, whether we're an appointed elder or whatever we may be. And as ministers, if I may use that term in that sense, that broad sense, then we must be constantly aware of setting the right example. I'm going to go to 1 Timothy 3, and while this is primarily about the ordained offices of elder and overseer, the appointments of elder and overseer, it is at the same time, it does, I should say, contain underlying principles that pertain to us all in one way or the other. Let's look at what he says here in the first 12 verses. He says, here is a worthy saying. If anyone sets his heart on being an overseer, that's bishop in the King James Version, it means elder, leader, pastor, so forth, all the same thing, he desires a noble task. Now, the overseer must be above reproach. What does that mean? I think it says blameless in the King James Version. And of course, you might say, well, none of us are blameless. Well, of course we're not. We're not blameless in the sense that there's any among us. There's nobody among us, of course, that has no flaws. All of us have flaws. But that's not what it's talking about. It says that the elder, the overseer, must be above reproach, meaning he can't have a reputation as a sinner. In other words, let me use an example. He can't be known as the town drunk. That's an extreme example, I realize. And then also carry on a ministry, because people will associate his other activities, his drunkenness, with his ministry. He must be above reproach. He can't have these things hanging all over his reputation. He has to be above reproach. Doesn't mean he has to be perfect, and it certainly doesn't mean someone who has committed sins in the past and those sins are known publicly can't be restored in due time to a useful and effective ministry. Doesn't mean he can't reach the status of being above reproach again, because time has a chance to heal. Things fade into the distant past. But in any case, this is talking about leaders here who must be above reproach. And connected to this, and the way it's worded here in the New International Version, it says, now the overseer must be above reproach, the husband of but one wife. Now this is something that comes up from time to time, because we have some elders in the Church of God International who have been married before and now have remarried. And a lot of people think, well, that's forbidden according to these qualifications. But in the Greek, this expression literally means one woman man. It doesn't mean that if he's had a wife before, something happens, say death, or even a divorce under certain circumstances, and then he later remarries, that he's now disqualified. That's not what it's talking about. It means one woman man. It means, in other words, he can't be a womanizer. Now, does anyone, I know the media has hammered this subject to death and we're all tired of it, but applying this principle across the board to leaders, not only in the church, but in the political world as well, is there anyone in here who would say that a man's morality or lack thereof has no effect on his leadership capabilities or upon his credibility? After what we've been through in the media, I don't think anybody would say that. Certainly, you can see why the Apostle Paul tells Timothy that an elder must be above reproach, the husband of one woman, a one-woman man, and he must be, continue here, temperate, self-controlled, respectable, hospitable, able to teach, not given to drunkenness, not violent but gentle, not quarrelsome, not a lover of money. He must manage his own family well and see that his children obey him with proper respect. If anyone does not know how to manage his own family, how can he take care of God's church? He must not be a recent convert, or he may become conceited and fall under the same judgment as the devil. He must also have a good reputation with outsiders, for reasons we've already talked about. He must have a good reputation with outsiders so that he will not fall into disgrace and into the devil's trap. Deacons likewise are to be men worthy of respect, sincere, not indulging in much wine and not pursuing dishonest gain. They must keep hold of the deep truths of the faith with a clear conscience. They must first be tested, and then if there is nothing against them, let them serve as deacons. In the same way, their wives are to be women worthy of respect, not malicious talkers, but temperate and trustworthy in everything. A deacon must be the husband of a one wife or a one-woman man, and must manage his children and his household well. So here you have these qualifications that are listed here primarily for elders, and yet there's this, the underlying principles apply to all of us in this corporate ministry, if you want to put it in those terms. And one of the main reasons here for these, not only is because so that the leader, in having these qualities, can do his job well in teaching and instructing others, but so that he can set a right example for them, and so that he can stand out as an example for the rest of the world who is looking on, so that reproach will not be brought to the name of God. You know, there's a lot of emphasis these days on ministries that have to do with recovery, whether recovering alcoholics or whatever. And I would have to just say to that if you have the example I gave earlier of the town drunk, the guy who's been 20 years an alcoholic, who struggled with the problem, but it's always got the best of him. And then one day, he does finally conquer the habit. 6 months down the road, he hasn't hit the bottle again. A year goes by, and he's doing well. Well, I believe certainly that he can carry on a ministry within the confines of the church or even on the outside by showing others how they can succeed. But you know, he can't do that if you put him in the pulpit. That changes everything. You can't have a man like that in the pulpit, not because he's not a good man, not because he hasn't accomplished something, but because his reputation from the recent past will be attached to his ministry. And again, the example, the message that is sent forth is that of, well, it's a bad example. It'll be attached to the rest of the church, the message that is sent. So every one of us is affected by the influence of others. But don't underestimate the influence that you have on others. Don't underestimate the power of example.